I'm Rich Egger, and this is Emphasis. Today's guest is Peter Bergen. He is author of Manhunt, the 10-year search for Bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad. Bergen will speak at Western Illinois University next Tuesday, February 19th, beginning at 7 p.m. in the University Union Heritage Rooms. The presentation is free and open to the public. Peter, were you surprised by the news that Bin Laden had been found and killed, or did you think it was just a matter of time?
Well, I was certainly surprised because I was aware of the fact that the trail seemed to have gone pretty cold. However, that said, clearly there was a small group of people at the CIA and at the White House who, in the summer of 2010, realized that there were some quite good leads. And, you know, in the long term, I thought it was likely that he would be found simply because, you know, he's a human being. Human beings make mistakes, and clearly he made a mistake at some point.
The president and his team, they were not 100% certain that was Bin Laden in that compound, were they?
Not at all. In fact, there was never a picture that confirmed his presence. There was no piece of intelligence that confirmed his presence. It was always a circumstantial case that he was there. And there were some people who found the circumstantial case convincing, and there were some people who found it less than convincing. And there was a debate in the White House Situation Room, but about this issue, a debate that went on for months and months and months.
Yeah. So how difficult of a call was this for President Obama?
I think it was quite difficult because at the end of the day, I mean, he was potentially risking his presidency on a call that was based on a circumstantial case. You know, a number of people, his senior advisors, Robert Gates, the Defense Secretary, Vice President Biden, and also his number two military advisor, General Cartwright, advised other courses of action. So it was by far, it was not a foregone conclusion at all that this was going to happen. Of course, there were risks in doing nothing also. If you did nothing, eventually the intelligence that he might be living in Pakistan in this city called Abbottabad might leak. He might disappear. So there were risks in doing nothing as well as doing something. Which is, I guess, you know, where you are when you're president.
Was this a shoot-to-kill mission, or were there any thoughts of capturing Bin Laden and bringing him to trial?
You know, they had a contingency plan for pretty much everything, including Bin Laden being captured and being wounded. There were people standing by in Afghanistan to interrogate him, FBI, CIA, Arab linguists, lawyers, if indeed he had been captured. I think the general view was that was quite unlikely. Bin Laden repeatedly said he's willing to die in his struggle, and eventually he did. And, you know, typically, you know, this kind of operation, you know, unless you come out and conspicuously surrender, which would have involved coming out and, you know, with his hands up, and at that point he would have been arrested. But failing that, there was really, I think it was unlikely that this was anything other than a kill operation.
Yeah, he didn't surrender, but he didn't grab a gun and fire back either, did he?
No, that's right. He had two guns in his room, an AK-47 and a smaller machine pistol, and he didn't reach for them. So why he didn't put up resistance is sort of hard to ascertain at this point. Obviously, he's not around to ask him the question, but he might have been paralyzed with fear or indecision. He might have been so surprised. It was a moonless night. The electricity, not only in his house, but the entire neighborhood had been turned off. It was a very confusing situation. A helicopter had crashed inside the compound where he lived. There was a brief firefight. So, you know, all of that might have contributed to his inaction. Or he may also have been concerned about firing his weapon in an enclosed space where many of his children and wives were living.
Yeah, he was a family man, wasn't he?
He was a family man. He had three wives and a dozen kids and grandkids living with him. He first got married when he was 17. His first wife actually left him for her native country, Syria, just before the 9/11 attacks. But a number of his other wives were living with him at the time of the raid.
President Obama and his team got to watch at least parts of this as it happened. What do you think are the pros and cons of allowing the commander-in-chief to see a tactical mission basically unfold before their eyes?
Well, as Admiral Mike Mullen said, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who I interviewed for the book, he was very concerned that the president or one of his advisors would intervene in the middle of this military operation as it was going on. Now, luckily, that didn't happen. And, he wasn't concerned. He was concerned. It wasn't a comment on President Obama or his team. He was just concerned that the technology has now allowed somebody in the Situation Room to monitor in real time a military operation on the other side of the world. And that's something that's, fairly unprecedented. And so there is this technological change that would allow the commander-in-chief or someone else to intervene as a tactical operation unfolds. And President Obama did not stop the operation after the helicopter went down. He just let it unfold, but he was watching in real time.
I suppose that takes a real nerves of steel to do that. I keep trying to imagine what it'd be like if FDR was able to watch the D-Day invasion as it unfolded, how that might have played out.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's one thing to order many people into battle. It's another thing to see them, be killed live on television on a monitor, as it would have been the case if there was some kind of ability to do this during the D-Day invasion. But, of course, there wasn't. But it does change the dynamics of some of these. It must change the way that people see these things, the fact that the technology allows you to see something unfold in real time.
Based on your research, do you feel the Pakistani government was a help or a hindrance in the search for bin Laden?
Oh, I would say they were overall a help. I mean, some of the key al-Qaeda leaders who've been arrested were arrested in Pakistan with Pakistani, at least, acquiescence and or help. There's no evidence to show that bin Laden was living in Pakistan with any official complicity. We've recovered thousands of documents from the compound where he lived. These documents don't point to official complicity. And it's also common sense, by the way. I don't think that bin Laden was a very paranoid, secretive, and disciplined guy, and unless you had a reason to really need to know where he was living, he was not telling people where he was living.
You've been to that compound before it was torn down, the compound where bin Laden had been living and where he was killed. Can you tell us a bit about what you saw?
Yeah, I mean, the compound, it's a pretty substantial compound that stretched over 1 acre. There were 24 people living there, so even though it was a fairly large place, it was cramped. And of course, many of the people who were living there were not going out. Bin Laden and his immediate family were sort of confined. Bin Laden was living there in a prison of his own making. It was a fairly rudimentary, in some senses, they were growing their own crops. They were, raising chickens and cattle, and they had bees to make honey. So they were pretty self-sufficient. There was no air conditioning in a place that gets fairly hot in the summer. There was some heating for a place that gets pretty cold in the winter. Each of bin Laden's three wives had her own little apartment and kitchen and toilet. Bin Laden himself lived on basically the top floor of a three-story main house. Pretty low ceilings, certainly not a luxurious setup. I went into his bathroom, which was about the size of a large closet. A small kitchen, probably the size of a larger closet, where bin Laden's youngest wife, the 29-year-old Yemeni, his most recent wife, would cook for him. Off to another side, there was sort of a study where bin Laden would compose lengthy memos to members of al-Qaeda, bookshelves where he kept books and computers. And, of course, all that material, much of it was swept up by the U.S. Navy SEALs when they did the raid operation, and the remainder of it was taken by the Pakistani intelligence services.
Any idea what the history of that building was before bin Laden moved into it?
Oh, bin Laden commissioned it himself, essentially. It was an open field. One of bin Laden's sort of henchmen bought about 4 parcels of land, which eventually would be used to build the compound. In 2005, they started building the compound, finished sometime in that year or early 2006, and bin Laden moved in at that time. So the building had always been made. It was specifically built for his use, and it was built in such a way that it wasn't easy to kind of get a good view of it from any angle. Particularly bin Laden's bedroom was kind of concealed behind a tall wall on the third floor, and the whole thing was designed to prevent surveillance of the people inside.
So based on all the interviews and research you've done, what are your thoughts regarding the role that torture or coercive interrogations played in finding bin Laden?
Well, I think coercive interrogations were certainly part of the war on terror. Now, the Senate Intelligence Committee has an unclassified, has yet to declassify any or all of a 6,000-page report. They've investigated this issue for 3 years. The chairman of that committee, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, a very serious individual, as well as Senator Carl Levin, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, have both publicly said that coercive interrogations did not yield the information that led to bin Laden. Certainly, there were people who were coercively interrogated who did give up information relevant to the hunt for bin Laden, but according to the Senate Intelligence Committee, that information was derived from them before they were coercively interrogated. To definitively set this question to rest, we'll have to wait for the declassification of as much as possible this report by the Senate Intelligence Committee, which could come, you know, in the next couple of months.
There is a documentary movie version of your book, Manhunt. Is that completed?
Yeah, it's finished. It was shown at the Sundance Film Festival in mid-January, and it'll be shown on HBO in May.
Are you satisfied with how that turned out?
Oh, yeah. The director, Greg Barker, did a terrific job. He used my book as a sort of springboard. You know, writing a book and doing a documentary are two very different animals. I mean, I've been writing books and also making documentaries for my professional life. And, you know, you can gain a lot of information on background in the course of reporting a book, which is very useful to, you know, in the narrative of the book. A documentary, by definition, you need people on camera. They can't be off the record or on background. They have to be on camera. They have to say what they, you know, what they say. And the director of the HBO film had to, you know, didn't get cooperation from people at the CIA right now. He was able to interview a number of very key people in the hunt for bin Laden, the fight against al-Qaeda, who've retired from the agency. And so his book, his documentary uses my book as a jumping-off point, and I'm very happy about it.
How sophisticated is al-Qaeda, and how dangerous do you think that organization is today?
Well, the organization that attacked us on 9/11, I think, is going the way of the dodo. It's on life support. It's not doing well. Its leaders are dead, captured.
Do you think we'll always be fighting a war against terror in some form?
I don't think we should be. I mean, you know, there's still, you know, communists around the world. We're still not fighting the Cold War. You know, our definition of success shouldn't be every jihadist militant around the world needs to be dead or in prison. That's never been our standard. You know, I think that we just need to move on. This conflict has already been the longest in American history, and it's time to kind of move on to other questions. The state of the U.S. economy is a much more important national security issue than the state of al-Qaeda at this point.
Journalist and national security expert Peter Bergen will speak Tuesday night, February 19th, at the University Union Heritage Rooms at WIU. There is no cost to attend. For Tri-States Public Radio News, I'm Rich Egger.